everybody. My name's Travis. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Sam for asking me to come speak tonight. Really appreciate that. So my sobriety date is September 30th, 2002. So hopefully I'll have an anniversary coming up in a week or two. And my home group is the Common Solution Group. We meet on Thursday nights at 7:30 in Charlottesville at the Hinton Avenue Methodist Church. So if you're ever in Charlottesville on a Thursday night, please come. It's an open meeting as well, so we'd love to have you all attend. When Sam called and asked me to speak, or he texted, I can't remember, but it was a few weeks ago, and I wasn't really thinking about the calendar. I just assumed that it would be football season and the Redskins would play at 1 o'clock. I'd watch the Redskins play and come on out to Madison. And sometimes we find that AA becomes a little inconvenient in our lives because the Redskins are actually playing at 4:30 today. So that being said, the Redskins can easily help me to lose my serenity and peace of mind. So this is probably the best place for me. And my sponsor has said numerous times that sometimes it's good when Alcoholics Anonymous becomes inconvenient. And I've thought about that. You know, why would he say that? Why should it be good that something's inconvenient? And I think the reason is because I'm very selfish and self-centered, and my character defects, my alcoholism manifests itself in this selfishness and self-centeredness, and therefore I'll try to make everything really easy for me. I'll try to make everything go my way. I will lie to tell people what it is I think they want to hear so that they'll like me better. I will rationalize and justify my actions, even if they're slightly inconsiderate or dishonest. I will tell myself that that's okay. And I don't know how I became that way or when that happened. And I'm not sure I would have classified myself as being selfish or self-centered prior coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. Those are terms that I learned here after going through an inventory and after having some sense of a spiritual awakening and after learning the principles that we try to practice in our lives, these things started to become clear to me. And I think that's part of the spiritual disease, the spiritual nature of alcoholism, is how that manifests itself in the selfishness and self-centeredness to the extreme. And the biggest way is most likely fear, self-centered fear. And for me, it's always been, what do other people think of me? Am I good enough? Am I smart enough? Am I cool enough? Am I hip enough? Am I athletic enough? Am I musically talented enough? Am I fill in the blank enough, right? And that's where I learned to be a liar. Like I said, at an early age, I would lie to tell people what it was I thought they wanted to hear. And later in life, when my consequences, typically from drinking, but any consequences, started to rear their head in my life, and I was caught, I would lie to get out of it, right? It's not that I didn't want to say I was sorry or admit I was wrong or stop doing those things. I just didn't want to be in trouble. And again, I would lie and tell people what it was I thought they wanted to hear, so that they would leave me alone and get off my back. And this started to manifest itself with, you know, at first my parents, and then counselors, doctors, later in life, lawyers and judges were all telling me, you know, you drank too much, you have a problem with this. And I was just like, yeah, how do I skate through? How do I get out of this one? How do I say what I need to say to not be in trouble? And at one time, when I was before a judge and I had been arrested for a DUI and some other charges, and it happened in D.C., and I would have applied qualified for a first-time offender status, and I could have gone to their special court in D.C., except it would have required me being in D.C. like 3 or 4 nights out of the week, and so I didn't want to drive back and forth at 5:30 after work and stay till 9 and have to come back every night. So the lawyer apprised me of a way that I basically throw my case to the mercy of the judge and let the judge decide whether she granted me a federal program for first-time offenders, which would allow me to then stay in Charlottesville and be on probation and all this other stuff. And it was going to be a really good deal, except that the judge ruled the other way. There was no way to appeal it. It was like, it would be like, you're guilty, go to jail with no right to appeal, or throw my case to the mercy of the judge and let her decide whether she would grant me this. So that's what we were going with. My lawyer, without promising me that he knew it was, could tell the future, he was like, let's go for it. You're most likely going to get it. It's going to be a safe bet. Let's go for it. And I was. In the first part, the judge was asking me all these questions about, did I understand my rights and did I understand the process that we were going through. It was very legal, and it was very like, yes, yes, Your Honor, yes, I understand. But then her line of questioning started getting more difficult. She started asking me about my alcohol use and my drug use, and when did I start drinking, and how many times had I been arrested for minor things in the past. And I was doing my best, to be honest, right? I have a habit of lying and telling people what it is I think they want to hear to stay out of trouble. And I'm under oath, and I'm doing my best to abide by that vow to tell the truth. And I remember she asked me, do you have God in your life? Do you go to church? And the answer was no, right? I did not. And that's in the face of my parents taking me to Sunday school and my parents taking me to church as a kid and trying to instill their sense of spirituality in my life. But I never got it. I didn't like going. I had no relationship with the God of my understanding, or at that time a God of my parents' understanding. And I didn't know how to pray, and I didn't know what that meant to pray and to forge and create this relationship with a higher power. So no, the answer to the judge's question was, I do not have God in my life. I do not go to church. And her reason for asking the question, because she followed it up with, I find that people who do typically do better in recovery, right? She had a little sense about maybe AA or NA or whatever her experience was, but she had a sense that spirituality would be helpful for people trying to recover from these things. And so there I was, standing before her with a microphone so the whole courtroom could hear all my answers. My parents are in the courtroom, and I don't know where the answer came from, but my answer was, I was raised in a Christian household, Your Honor, and that satisfied the question. I didn't have to lie. Long story short, she did end up granting me the program and was able to have my probation transferred down to Charlottesville. So, you know, I tell that because it's indicative and it's descriptive of me as wanting to tell people what they want to hear so that they'll leave me alone. It's indicative of where I came from before coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, with a lack of spirituality in my life. And as the reading that Matt read when we started, you know, talks about the stories people tell, how we came to have a relationship with God. And that's one of the most important aspects of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? This is a spiritual program based on recovery via spiritual principles. And that's one way that alcoholism affects me. You know, the other side, I call it the triple-edged sword, right? It's physical, it's mental, and it's a spiritual disease. And the physical part is that when I put alcohol in my body, I can't control how much I'm going to drink. And the mental part is I have an obsession with it, that I always think alcohol is going to make things better. And again, when I was drinking, I never would have classified myself as an alcoholic. I knew that I drank to excess. I knew that I liked to party. I liked to get drunk. I liked the effect alcohol gave me because I was, like I mentioned, I was very fearful of what people thought of me, and that kind of made me shy and reserved and to myself, full of that fear. But alcohol quieted all that. Alcohol would kind of let me feel comfortable in my own skin and okay, and gave me a peace of mind and a serenity that I didn't have otherwise. And so I liked the effects of alcohol. I liked the way it made me feel. In high school, in ninth grade is when I first started drinking, and I was probably a bit of, I don't know what the right term is, but a nerd or a dork or a geek or whatever. And for some reason, I associated the cooler people in school with the ones that were drinking. And it seemed like a path for me towards that. So I started drinking and started to hone my skills as a partier, a weekend warrior. And I took that all the way through college. I went to a notorious party school, been number one in the Playboy's top 20 party school rankings numerous times. And it served me well. I had a great time while at school. I don't remember a lot of it. Some people talk about blackouts or like, oh, I don't remember a night or I don't remember a weekend or I don't remember a week. I don't remember the 90s, right? They're just like, So I was doing a lot of drinking to excess because that's what I liked. I liked the effect of alcohol. It made me feel good. Unfortunately, it started to bring problems with it that eventually outweighed whatever benefits alcohol was giving me. And then they started off small, you know, minor wrecks, fights with friends. I was a puker. I would throw up and black out, pass out, gray out, fall off bar stools. I one time passed out in an inner tube while floating down the James River. And if my friends hadn't kind of pulled me off to the side, I would have floated all the way down to Richmond, I guess. But and then they got worse, right? And then there were major car wrecks, minor arrests, then major arrests, and that's plural, right? Not just the one in D.C. And so once it got bad enough, I had to start looking at the life I was living. And that first arrest didn't do anything for me. My near-death car accident didn't do anything for me. I flipped the truck over into a pond, and I left it there that night and went out drinking. Like, left it in the after I swam out. And left it there because it didn't faze me. It was just, these were minor speed bumps along the way of living the life that I wanted to live, which included excessive drinking because I liked the way it made me feel. And I was okay with that. I was willing to suffer these consequences as part of the deal, right? But after the first arrest, when I told people things like, you don't have to worry about me, I've learned my lesson, I don't really drink like that all the time, this was just a one-off type thing, I'm not going to do that again, et cetera, telling people what it is that I thought they wanted to hear so that they would leave me alone. And less than a year later, I was arrested for all the same events and same charges. And it was then that it was painfully obvious to me, at least in my perception, that everybody else now knew the truth about me, that I was a liar. And they knew it, and they knew I was no good. And even though my family never said anything at that time, my understanding was, I've really done it this time. I've crossed the line. This is now, we've moved into a position where they're not going to forgive me. They're not going to love me after this. Like, I've hurt them too badly because of my lies, and I'm exposed for that. And that second arrest happened in North Carolina, and I didn't have anybody to call. I was 31 years old. And I called my parents, and they came down to bail me out of jail in North Carolina. And when we got in the car, the van, actually, they didn't say a word. And it was like a 3.5-4-hour drive back to Charlottesville. They didn't say a word. We drove the entire way in silence. They didn't even turn the radio on. And that was the longest, worst van ride of my life. But that feeling of shame and guilt and remorse and fear that came post, in the, like the next week of that event. And I hear people, we go to open discussion meetings and these things come up as topics. Let's talk about guilt. Let's talk about shame. Let's talk about remorse, whatever. And they tend to have this like negative connotation when we talk about those emotions. But honestly, those are the right four emotions that I should have been feeling. I was guilty. I should be feeling guilty about this. I had shamed myself with my lies and my actions. I was remorseful. And I had a lot of fear about losing my job or going to jail. And fear about damaging the relationship with the family. So those were the right emotions to be feeling at the time. I didn't know what to do. I made some phone calls. It started with, again, I wanted to look good. I wanted to, before going back for the initial hearing in North Carolina with the judge, I wanted to take some proactive actions that would look good. And I started making phone calls, like check myself into a treatment center kind of thing. Let's show the judge that I'm serious. But before he gets a chance to pass judgment, let's show him that I'm moving in the right direction here. And so I did, and it was in the first week, right? So that was the decision, called the outpatient treatment center. The greatest thing they did for me was suggest that their program included going to 3 meetings with Alcoholics Anonymous and getting a sponsor during the time that I spent my 5 weeks with them. And bar none, that was the greatest thing they've ever did for me. And I did, and within that first week of going to a couple AA meetings, something changed in my perception of this, and I no longer only wanted to look good for the judge. I was done. I wanted to change my life. I had lost hope in the lifestyle that I was living. I talked about being a weekend warrior and a party guy. It started off, the weekend was always Friday and Saturday, and then the weekend became Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and then the weekend became Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, because I couldn't sleep on Sunday nights after drinking for 3 nights in a row, so now I got to drink a 6-pack on Sunday just to calm my nerves so I can get to sleep at night. And then before I knew it, it's Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday was just a mess, right? So I just was tired of living that lifestyle. I didn't want it anymore. I wasn't sure what AA was going to offer me. I'd heard of AA. I guess I'd seen it on TV or movies or whatever, but I had no idea what it was all about. And I came here in that state, and I think that's the best state to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, because if I'm kind of beat down by the consequences of my drinking and I'm a little bit desperate about the way life's going and I've lost hope in living that way and I just want to change and I don't want to keep living that way, then I'm going to be more receptive to the things that are suggested and offered here. It's a bit of a drastic program, right? Alcoholics Anonymous is not for the faint of heart. We have some serious things to look at when we do our steps, inventory, a fearless and searching personal inventory, sharing that information with somebody, going back to make amends for our harms and wrongs. These are our drastic proposals. And our book does say, at some of these we balked. And it's my experience that people do balk at steps 4, 5, 9, and 12. Right? They don't want to do inventory. They don't want to share that inventory. They don't want to make amends. They don't want to work with others. That's where we balk. But I was in that defeated state of mind, and I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember at my first meeting, the guy who gave me my white chip, which as it turns out is now one of my closest friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. But at that time, he was just some guy at the meeting doing the chips that day. And after he gave it to me, he said, you should listen to what people share at meetings. And if somebody shares something that strikes a chord with you, that has weight and depth and meaning to you, you should go up and talk to that person. That might be a good person to be your sponsor. And so about a week later, I was at a meeting, and a gentleman said, God is on the inside trying to get out, not on the outside trying to get in. I'd never heard anything like that before. And that struck a chord with me. I now know today that that's an ancient spiritual belief. The Christians call it the Holy Ghost or the Holy Spirit. The Buddhists call it the divine spark. And this idea that there's a little bit of God inside of us, inside trying to get out. The big book talks about it. Deep down inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. So this wasn't something new. This is new to me. And he paraphrased it in a way that hit home. And so I did. I went up and I talked to him. And we talked about sponsorship. He did not start sponsoring me immediately, but he was like, let's get together. Let's talk about it. And we did. And he did become my sponsor. And I've had the same sponsor for almost 15 years. And have done a lot. And the gifts that he gave me, I can't repay him. Because it was so much of his time. The only way that I can give it back is by being active in Alcoholics Anonymous, myself, and being willing to give that same free time to people who ask. When I was getting around to making amends, I had gone to school in Morgantown, West Virginia, for college. And I had to go back there. I had shoplifted and stolen some things, so they were on my amends list. And my sponsor asked me, well, what are you going to do about that? I don't know. Write them a check? send them the money in the mail? And he was like, no. He was like, it's not that far. It's a five-hour drive, right? He was like, it's not that far. He was like, you should go make these amends in person. Wherever possible, we make them in person. And I'll tell you what, I'll go with you, right? I mean, that's the kind of thing my sponsor did for me. He was willing, when we say we do this together, it's a we program. No one here does it by ourselves, and our sponsors hopefully show us the way rather than point and tell us what to do. They show us how to do it. And so I'm real grateful for that. My one plug on sponsorship is we hear it all the time at meetings, right? Don't drink. Go to meetings, get a sponsor. Those are all a great beginning to Alcoholics Anonymous, right? But there's a lot more to do than just that. But no one ever tells us what to look for that makes someone an effective sponsor. It's always just don't drink, go to meetings, get a sponsor. Well, how do I know that the person I'm asking to be my sponsor is doing AA? How do I know that they have a sponsor themselves? How do I know that they've taken the steps? How do I know that they're well-read in the literature, in the history, in the traditions? How do I know that they're going to be willing to give me some time to help me through the steps? How do I know any of this? I don't. And we don't hear a lot of that. We hear, get a sponsor, but not what makes someone an effective sponsor. And thankfully, luckily for me, the person that I asked is all those things. He's very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. He has a sponsor himself. He had a plan to take me through the steps. We talk about the traditions. We talk about the history. We talk about the literature. I was very early in sobriety, and this might have been a mistake on his part, but he suggested that I read Alcoholics Anonymous Comes of Age. That is a very dry book. If you have trouble sleeping at night, go ahead and pull that one out. I'm a much bigger fan of Language of the Heart. Language of the Heart is a fantastic book. It's a lot of Bill Wilson's writings from the 40s, 50s, and 60s that were mostly published in the Grapevine at the time, but it covers so much of the traditions and the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a fantastic book, and since it's all little three-page articles from the Grapevine, you know, you can read for like 5 or 10 minutes and put it down. So I stumbled into someone, and I was active in AA, that was willing to help me from the very beginning. he was like, hey, I want you to go to, you know, 5 meetings a week. I want you to come meet me once a week before or after a meeting so we can read in the big book and find where the steps are. I want you to come to Buckingham on a meeting on Tuesday nights. And he was like, can you do all this stuff? I was like, yeah, you know, not a problem. I didn't have much of a life going on at that time. I was just coming off this big arrest. My car had been confiscated, not impounded, where you pay the money and get it out of hock. Like, confiscated, they took it, they weren't giving it back. Yeah, it was pretty harsh. But my lawyer said let him keep it. He was like, I could fight, I could get it back. Absolutely no problem, they cannot keep your car. But his line of reasoning was, but if we do that, they're going to want to stick it to you on all these other charges. They're like, let them keep the car. We'll get these other charges reduced and dropped and let you walk out of here a free man. I said, that's a good plan. Let's go with that one. So we didn't fight the confiscation. We just let them have it. But I didn't have much going on. And then interestingly, when he was like, hey, I want you to come to Buckingham on Tuesday nights. It's about an hour drive. He said, but don't worry, I got this other guy in Charlottesville who's coming, and I'll set y'all up, y'all can ride together. That turned out to be the person who had given me my white chip a couple weeks before, so we started having this long drive of an hour each way, you know, hardly knowing each other, but if you do that ride with someone every Tuesday night for close to 15 years, you're going to become pretty good friends, right? So grateful there. Again, it's a we program, right? My sponsor didn't just throw me out there alone. He set me up with people who were also doing the deal. Very early on, we started going to weekend conferences. He was like, come on, hop in the car. We're going to Richmond. We're going to Williamsburg. We're going to Philly. We're going to Baltimore. We're going to Virginia Beach. And my first, I don't know, 6 or 9 months, I went to about 6 out-of-town AA conferences, usually with a full car or 2 full cars, like at least 4 people, but maybe 6 or 8 people going to these things. And I was probably a year or two sober before it dawned on me that that's not what everybody in AA is doing. Like, that's how active my sponsor was. And he instilled these habits in me at an early time in sobriety, and so that's very important, because when life comes to play, and life does come to play, and when I get selfish and self-centered and full of self and thinking like, what's in it for me, how does this affect me, this is kind of bothersome, I don't want to do this, it becomes inconvenient, right? It's my feet. It's the practice of the habits that take me to the meetings, you know, and I go to typically the same meetings every week, and then I have one that I try to mix around because it's nice to see new faces and new friends and meet new people in AA, maybe meet some newcomers to work with, but those committed meetings, that's the same meeting, the same night, on the same day of the week at the same time, those are the ones where if I've had a bad day at work and I'm at home and I just want to lie on the couch and watch TV and rest, the next thing I know I'm kind of getting ready and I'm out the door driving to the AA meeting because it's habit and it's been instilled, and I'm really grateful for that. Going to meetings is a great place for me to share the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think we all go through phases where we want to, well, I do, because it's my natural tendency. You know, not only am I a liar, cheater, and a thief, but I'm prone to resentment, I'm judgmental, I'm selfish, I'm self-centered, I'm inconsiderate. I'm all these things that affect my spiritual life based on alcoholism and my character defects, you know, can get in the way at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings too. And I can get real judgmental of, did you hear what that person shared? That meeting wasn't even on an AA topic. What, nobody's talking about recovery? And I start going through all that stuff. And eventually, you know, I come through the other side of that, and I realize that all AA meetings are great meetings, and it's just me. I'm the sick bastard with the judgmental mindset, and I'm the one that's judging all this stuff. And if I can let that go and remember, what am I doing? What am I sharing something positive in the meeting? And so Alcoholics Anonymous meetings give me an opportunity to do that. But they also allow me to listen to what other people share, right? It's a we program, and to hear everybody else's experience, strength, and hope is some of the most important times of my week. Because I forget what we're doing here. I forget to admit when I'm wrong. I forget to not rationalize or justify my actions to being like, oh, that's okay. That wasn't so bad. That was just a little thing. You know, it's no big deal. I forget about prayer and meditation. I forget about trying to help others. I forget all the things that AA presents to us as our solution. You know, our spiritual toolbox. It's a lot of tools in that toolbox. It's a lot. And I learned those things from taking the steps. And I learned those things from having a home group. And I learned those things from having a sponsor. And I learned those things from active participation where I watch other people going through this and applying these principles in their lives. And then I'm reminded, oh yeah, maybe I haven't been doing that. Oh yeah, maybe I've been treating someone poorly. Oh yeah, maybe I'm not quite as spiritual as I think I am or I think I want to be, right? It's not so much that I think I am, it's like where I want to be. You know, there's a lot of growth that still needs to happen. And the great thing about AA is growth can start from anywhere. When I walked into the rooms of AA, I had no spiritual life. I had no idea of what God was. And it was my sponsor who said, God's on the inside trying to get out. And I wanted to talk to him about that. And I just remember when we were in the first and second steps and we started talking about God, and I had no real definition of it. I know that some nights, if it's like a really starlit sky, I find that fascinating. I find nature to be majestic and beautiful with mountains and rivers and oceans and all these things that definitely not man-made, right? And so there's something there for me. There's some connection that way. And thankfully, he didn't say, nor has anyone ever said to me, nor did anyone say at that time, do you believe in God? You better believe in God right now, because if you don't believe in God, you got to go. You're not welcome here if you don't believe in God. Right? No, that's not what was said. Right? It was just like, let's talk about it. Can you maybe admit by some stretch of the imagination that there might possibly be a God? Yeah, I can start there, right? Let's just start with saying, I don't have to be an atheist, or I don't have to be agnostic, or I don't have to be so defiant. You know, I quit going to church and Sunday school with my parents when I was about 14. Made my mom cry on Christmas Eve when I wouldn't go to church with her. Turned my back on that all through those years of drinking, you know, the 90s, right? And came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous void of any spiritual, you know, spiritually bankrupt, as they say. And so to just say, you know what, sure, maybe there is a God. Let's have an open mind about this. That's a starting point, right? Growth via the 12 steps and participation in Alcoholics Anonymous begins where we are. We can all start at wherever we are. And if someone is an altar boy and well-read in their faith and has a great understanding of God, they can go from there and take the steps and have their experience to see what happens, right? For me, it was from a much very basic point of view, but something happened, right? Something happened. I don't know what happened. I took the steps. I got active in AA. I've stayed active in AA. There was a time. So AA is can be a time commitment, right? It can be inconvenient, especially if you're going to five meetings a week, working with sponsees, working with the sponsor, doing things. And I was living my life and was going to work and doing AA. And I was training for an Ironman triathlon, which was taking about 20 hours a week on top of work in AA. It was a pretty big commitment. And I had already made the down payment. It cost me $800 to do that race. And you know, I can get real tight with my money, so it wasn't like I was going to stop the training and then not do the race. And then I started dating someone. And prior to this, so this was in 2014, but in 2011 I had been dating a girl, and we were getting a little bit more serious, boyfriend, girlfriend. And she got real mad at me one night, and she was like, "You make me feel like I'm third in your life, third behind AA and triathlon training." And I was kind of like, I didn't say this, but I'm smart enough not to say it, right? But yeah, you kind of are. And that relationship didn't work out. There were other problems with it other than that. But so here I am now. It's 2014. I've had that experience. I've now bumped up my triathlon training. It's much more time consuming than it was. And the girlfriend that I had at this time, maybe I liked her more than the other one. Maybe I was more in love with her. Maybe it's whatever it was. When she said the same, maybe I learned my lesson, right? But it was the same then. Right? You don't have enough time. You are constantly going to AA meetings and you're always on your bike or swimming or doing something. There's like, where's the time for the relationship? And I said, okay. Really want to be in this relationship. Don't want to lose you. I had a breakup over this before. And I remember calling my sponsor to talk to him about it, because what I was going to do was stop going to that meeting in Buckingham that he wanted me to go to from, 12 years earlier that I'd been going to for 12 years. And my kind of compromise for both of them that I came up with on my own was, well, I'll just go every other week. Now I'll satisfy my sponsor and her by splitting the difference going every other week. And when I remember having that conversation, and I was expecting the pushback from the sponsor, well, you agreed to go to any length, or you agreed to do this, but he didn't. He was just like, okay, whatever you want, Travis. So I did. At 12 years of sobriety, I started cutting back on my meetings. And my sponsor was great because he allowed me to have that experience, right? He didn't, and he told me later, he was like, no matter what I told you, you were going to do what you were going to do. There was like, he was like, why fight it? And that's like the wisdom of AA. That's the wisdom of sponsorship coming through. You know? And that's what I've learned in that lesson is now when my sponsees tell me something, I'm like, yeah, whatever, man. Either do it or you're not, right? Because then if I fight them on it, it just makes the relationship go south. And this way, my sponsor allowed it so that we could still have the relationship that we have today. And that relationship didn't work out either. And I went through this period of where a lot of my close friends said they were worried about me, right? That they saw me cutting back on my AA meetings, and they saw me spending more and more time doing other things. And I don't know what my demeanor or attitude or personality was like during that time. Maybe it changed, maybe it didn't, right? I don't know. I know that Alcoholics Anonymous helps keep my demeanor, my personality in a much more friendly way, right? Because I get real selfish and self-centered and full of fear and full of resentment. I can't believe they did this. And the next time I see them, I'm going to say this, and I should have said that, and I'm going to get back with them. and then I get that thing running over and over in my head, coupled with the judgmental machine and the intolerance, and then the lying and the cheating and all this stuff. It's like, whoa, man, you know, like that's where my character defects start to come out, and I don't know how to keep them in check. Alcoholics Anonymous knows how to keep them in check, because we talk about spiritual principles. We give me tools and guidelines to live my life by that I learned from taking the steps. Like, I would not have learned to admit when I'm wrong had it not been for the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Prior to that, if I had done something dishonest or cheated or thought I had gotten away with something, then I'm not copping nobody, right? I'm going to lie about it all day long. There was one time, and here's, I'll tell you how stupid I am. So my dad's 50th birthday party, and I was, I don't know, 16 or 17, and a bunch of my dad's friends gave him a bunch of liquor for his birthday. So I'm going to steal one of these bottles of liquor, because there's like 50 of them sitting there, and he's not going to know. He's not going to miss one. But stupid me, I take the most unique one that my dad had never had before, right? I didn't take like the Jim Beam or the Jack Daniels. Man, I took like the exotic bottle. So of course he missed it. And I drank it with some friends, and we didn't even get to drink it all. Somebody spilt it, and I knocked it over, and we spilt it. We didn't even get to drink it all. We had some of it. And but that came up like numerous times. Like, somebody took that bottle of liquor. Was it you? No, Dad, I didn't steal your bottle of liquor. And like years later, it was like my parents couldn't let it go, right? It was like one of those memories that it was always coming up at like the picnic or the barbecue and telling stories. Remember that time somebody stole a bottle of liquor? I think it was you. And I was like, no, it wasn't me, right? Because if I think I got away with it, I'm not coming honest. I'm going to deny it. Well, I had to make amends for that, right? You know, after being accused of that like five times over like a 15-year period, they'd be like, hey, Dad, remember that bottle of liquor? It was me. You were right. You know, and, but that's how I am, right? I don't learn, like, whatever makes people successful and kind and compassionate and effective and giving and helpful in life. It's like, I didn't get that. Like, I don't know. Maybe it's like, you know, something wrong in my DNA. Maybe it's just my alcoholism, right? Maybe that there's just like, there's something that's like not quite there. But Alcoholics Anonymous fixes that for me. It shows me, it's, if we go through the steps and we go through the inventory and you know, the fourth step, we look at what drives our resentments and what drives our fears and what drives our inconsiderate behavior, and we share that stuff with somebody, and you know, I get off the hook, right? Because I got all this stuff that I'm ashamed of and I'm scared of telling somebody, because I don't want to be, you know, the flip side of that coin of being a very judgmental person is I hate to feel like I'm being judged myself, right? That's that fear of what people think of me. I don't, but I do with everybody else, you know. It's a terrible thing. And so, fifth step, I'm going to share the stuff that I'm ashamed of, you know, and I don't want to be judged on it, but I get it off the hook. That's it? Well, we've all done something like that. You know, you stole a bottle of liquor, you know, you locked your own beer up when you went to a keg party so you'd have some after the party was over. It's like, you know, Trev, that's not so bad. Most of us have done those types of things. It's like, oh. It's not so bad, right? I get let off the hook. And then we make amends for stuff, and we try our best to set it right. And I learn that that's okay. Like, because then people are like, they don't hate you after it, typically. You know, my experience with making amends, they were all very positive. You know, people are kind, forgiving people. And I've learned to be a more compassionate and helpful and caring person here. Doesn't mean I'm always that way, right? I describe the spirituality as being a spectrum. You know, my spiritual condition, I used to hear, or I read that phrase of the book, you know, like, we have a daily reprieve based on our spiritual condition. That's what I thought I was hearing all the time. And that's not what it says at all, right? So we have a daily reprieve based on the maintenance of my spiritual condition, which means if I'm doing the work, if I'm praying, if I'm meditating, if I'm coming to meetings, if I'm trying to be helpful, if I'm helping set up chairs, if I'm helping clean up, am I helping make coffee, am I pitching in, if I'm doing the maintenance, I get the daily reprieve regardless of where my spiritual condition is, because some days I might be real selfish and full of fear, and other days I might be real giving and helpful and praying, right? It's a continuum. It's a spectrum. Typically, I find I'm somewhere in the middle, right? And so my spiritual condition is always changing. And I learned this from AA. I learned how to be helpful and giving. I remember when I first started thinking about spiritual principles and things like forgiveness and being kind and loving. And I remember having an issue because I didn't feel it. Right? I didn't feel forgiving. And I didn't feel kind and loving. And I was having a conversation with my sponsor about that. I was like, I don't feel forgiving. I don't feel loving. And he said, Travis, you know, that's okay. It's like, do you know how a forgiving and loving person might act? I said, yeah, I think so. And he's like, well, just do that. Just do that. Act. Act as if. And that's been huge. I mean, it's the program of action here, right? It doesn't say we hemmed and hawed and thought about it and sat on our laurels and rested and did nothing. It says we launched onto a course of vigorous action, right? I mean, those are some powerful words. Launch, vigorous, action, right? It's a program of action. And that's what I was taught early on. It doesn't matter what I feel, but act as if. And through that process, again, what it does, it teaches me things. What I've learned in AA has gone out into the rest of my life and made me more effective at work. It's made me a better person in the relationships with my family and with friends. It's just, they're the tools to a successful life that I never had before. And they're the tools that help me not drink, you know, one day at a time for as long as I'm willing to do this stuff. And, you know, there's a guy in Charlottesville that sometimes people bristle because his presentation at open discussion meetings can be a little blunt and brusque, and he throws in the F-bomb for emphasis, and he's like, just don't effing drink. That's all you gotta do. Go to meetings and don't, and it's like, ooh, and if you've got, you know, people in there that are like, no, you gotta do all these things in Alcoholics Anonymous that we talk about, sometimes that gets at odds. And for years now, I've never been at odds with this guy, because he's right. You gotta not drink. You gotta not drink. But the part that he's leaving out is that by doing the rest of the stuff, it makes the not drinking easier, right? It's not only does taking the steps and going to meetings and sharing with my sponsor and praying and meditating, and sometimes through prayer and meditation, getting glimpses of, oh, that's a very clear-cut answer. It's the most obvious, simplest, clearest, best solution ever. I get this stuff, but doing that, it helps me overcome drinking, right? Because drinking is but a symptom, right? I drank because I liked the effects. Drinking wasn't the problem. Drinking was the solution. I like alcohol. I like the way it makes me feel. And I would have never have known this, right? The idea that when I put one drink in me, I can't control the amount. But when I started talking to that with my sponsor, and it dawned on me, that was like my entire drinking career. There were so many times that I said, I only want to have two. Well, maybe three. I want to have three. Because just enough to take the edge off, right? It's a Thursday night. I don't want to get drunk. I got to get up. I don't want to be hungover. It's Saturday afternoon. I got to meet my parents for dinner. Whatever it was, I had a valid reason for not wanting to get drunk, but I didn't like the way I felt. I didn't like the way I was uncomfortable in my own skin and the way my mind was full of fear. And I knew alcohol helped with that. So yeah, why can't I just have two or three, just enough to take the edge off? I'm just going to have two or three. And then I was drunk, right? I would have two or three, and then if I tried to stop, it would be like the worst white-knuckling, you know, 20 or 30 minutes experience ever, where you're like, I'm only having two. I'm only having two. And then no. And then it's like, oh. Like that one, when you surrender to the fight of I'm only going to have two, but have three, oh, the third one's the best. You're like, oh, God, what was I thinking, right? I never would have known that that's alcoholism, right? Like, I had these preconceived notions that to be alcoholic or to suffer from alcoholism meant you had to be homeless, lost a wife, sitting on the park bench with the brown paper bag, living under the bridge, whatever it was, right? That's not me. I still had a house and a job. I didn't have an ex-wife because I was never married. But when we break it down to when you drank and you can't control the amount you take, maybe you're alcoholic. And even that doesn't quite make sense to me. But when through discussions with somebody, it's like, well, have you ever just wanted to have two or three and then couldn't stop after two? Oh, yeah, like all the time, right? That's when I got it. It was like that in that way. And that's one of the greatest things of Alcoholics Anonymous, too, is the idea that one alcoholic gets through to another alcoholic where no one else can. Because prior to that, like I said, my parents, counselors, doctors, later lawyers and judges, all sorts of people try to get through to me and tell me, you have a problem with alcohol. Maybe you should not drink. Maybe you should moderate. Maybe you should, you know, stay at home and not drink and drive. That's when you're going to get yourself in trouble. Maybe you should do all this stuff. And I was always like, no, leave me alone. You don't understand. I'm okay. It's not a big deal. Whatever it was, get them off my back, right? The old, I didn't have a drinking problem. I had a back problem. And the boss was on my back. The wife was on my back. Parents were on my back. But an alcoholic armed with the facts of their sobriety, their recovery, the 12 steps of AA, the literature, the traditions, the history, the spiritual tools of the principles that we live by, their own past, their own drinking, their own consequences, where they were sitting in jail, where they drank like that, where they felt like that, where they acted like that. Someone who's armed with all those facts gets through to another alcoholic like that. And that's what happened to me. You know, that when I first started talking to my sponsor, there was no more like, yeah, buts, or no, you don't understand. It was like, yeah, I drank like that. Yeah, I acted like that. And he never told me, you have a problem. He was just talking about himself. And I saw myself clearly in that. And that's really, I think, the magic of AA is when one person gets through to another. And that opens the door, right? Because I've firmly come to believe that most of us, most of the people I know in AA think like me, act like me, feel like me, and drink like me, and can recover like me, right? Because it's a we program. And that's what I got from my sponsor when I was like, I'm just like this guy. And he was 15 years sober at that time. Now he's almost 30 years, or he may have just celebrated 30 years. You know, if I'm just like that, and he's sober and in recovery, well, I can have that too. All I got to do is let him show me what he did. And I've tried. Try my best. Don't always get there. I come up short sometimes. But that's it. It's a we program, and we can help each other more than anybody else. So thank you very much for letting me share.